Well, this appears to be our last service in this weekend of special studies, and since this is our last time together this weekend, let me say again how much I appreciate having been invited to come your way. I have thoroughly enjoyed the time that we've spent together. It's been so good to see again some of you whom I'd known in the past and to meet others of you whom I'd not met before. I've really enjoyed getting to spend a little bit of time with George and Nancy Slover. I've known the Slovers in the past, but really had never had a chance to be around them very much, and I've thoroughly enjoyed that this weekend. George is a gospel preacher whom I highly admire and look up to in the Lord's work. He's a good deal older than I am, and so he's a role model for me. All seriousness, George is just the very epitome of what a gospel preacher ought to be. He has a fine attitude and grasp of God's word, and in humility stands for the truth of what God teaches and has affected many lives. And I'm sure you're glad to have the opportunity to work with him here, not only as an evangelist, but as one of your elders. It's been good to meet the other men who serve as your overseers here. You appear to be well led, and that makes for a profitable work together when you have good leadership. And you're obviously blessed in that regard here, as you are in many other ways. I've very much been pleased and pleasantly made aware of the many positive things that you have about your work here. You obviously enjoy one another, enjoy working together. You have a good relationship. So I've been refreshed by being here. I must admit I was tired when I got here. I've been on the road for most of the last month. But I will come away from your presence refreshed. You have invigorated me spiritually, and I thank you for that. I try to be an encourager of other people, but I'll tell you, it just always happens that I end up being more encouraged than the people that I try to encourage. And that's been the case this weekend. I'm indebted to you for having given me a shot in the arm that I very much needed. Thanks for the hospitality, the meals that we've had together, and would certainly invite you to give me a call if you're ever through Nashville, Tennessee. Give me a call, and if I'm home, I'll be happy to fix you some pinto beans and cornbread and show you some Tennessee hospitality. Not as good as Texas hospitality, admittedly, but we do the best we can in Tennessee. So thanks for being who you are. I'm glad that we've had our time together, and I hope that it's been helpful to you. I know it has been helpful to me to think about these things again. As I said to you in the first lesson, these are very meaningful truths to me personally. These truths grew out of a struggle to really recover my own faith in the midst of a considerable hardship in my life. And so I believe these things not only be true, but they're very important truths to me, and I hope that they would be to you as well. I apologize for having spoken overtime at every service. I've spoken longer than I intended to every time I've been up here. I had a fellow actually pray in a meeting a couple of years ago where I was speaking. He said, Lord, help Brother Henry to have a ready recollection of some of the things that he is prepared to say, but not necessarily all of them. And so you've been indulgent about listening, and I thank you for that. Well, let's read Hebrews 11, verse 6 one more time. We've seen it several times already. This has been the basis of our thoughts. Without faith, it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. We've talked about whether God can be pleased, and we've been encouraged to see that in Christ, by faith, we can please God. We need to have a stronger faith that God is, and to learn what's truly involved in seeking God. It's far more than the silly little thing that many people in these days have in mind when they talk about seeking God. This is about God and not about us. And we talked about the reward, that it is God himself. He desires to once again have with us the perfect relationship that he intended when he made creatures in his image that will be capable of loving him and responding to his love. And so we talked also this morning about why diligence is so important. Seeking God is more than just a matter of convenience. It's more than just a matter of casually doing something that is of a little bit of interest to us. This must be the center of our lives, the thing that matters more to us than everything else combined. So we want to end by talking about our motives. What should be the reasons or the motives that would move us toward God? Why would we want to seek Him and to seek Him diligently? It would be impossible, I think, to overestimate the importance of our motives. Whether you're thinking about God or some worldly endeavor, our motives are very, very important. A man by the name of Keith Yamashita, who is not a religious teacher by any means, he's a business consultant, but he has distinguished himself as a man who has the ability to come into large corporations that are struggling and to help them see how they can do things better. And he made this statement. He says, all meaningful change starts with right aspiration. Now, I think he's right about that. What we aspire to, that's what we're trying to do. It's our goal. And so his thought is that if we want to improve the quality of what we're doing, if we can take a look at what we're trying to do and elevate the reasons for which we're trying to do that, aspire to higher things, then that will change what we're doing in meaningful ways. So I say it this way. Motive is the key to motivation. If you want to be more strongly motivated to do something, you need to look at the reasons why you're doing that in the first place. And if you can elevate the quality of your motives, then you're going to be more strongly motivated. And if the motivation is in God's direction, then that's certainly the most important kind of motivation. If I ask you what you think was wrong with religion as most people practice it, what would you say? There are obviously a lot of specific errors out there, you know, specific doctrines and practices that are wrong. But if you wanted to boil all of it down and say, what's the basic thing that's wrong with the way most people approach the whole subject of religion, what would you say? Well, I'm the speaker, so I get to answer the question. Let me give you my answer. Here's what it is. I think most people's approach, even to religion, is self-centered. That's kind of amazing even to say that, because you'd think of all the subjects in the world that you couldn't turn the subject of religion into something that's about ourselves, because that's about God. But I'm afraid that's exactly what many people do. They take the most unself-centered subject in the world and they turn that into something that's about them and about their desires. And that's truly tragic. We will have perverted religion in the worst possible way if we turn it into something that is about us. But many people, if not most people, have done that. Do you remember the passage in John chapter 6 where Jesus had fed the 5,000 with the loaves and the fishes the previous day? And then the next day, what happened? The crowds came back looking for another meal. And they were seeking him. In fact, they had gone to some trouble to find where he was the next day. But do you remember what Jesus said? John 6 and 26. Most assuredly, I say to you, you seek me. Now, that's what we've been trying to do this weekend, isn't it? Talk about seeking God. He says, you seek me, but not because you saw the signs, but because you ate of the loaves and were filled. So do not labor for the food which perishes, he says, but for the food which endures to everlasting life, which the Son of Man will give you, because God the Father has set his seal on him. Jesus pointed out to these people that they were seeking him, but they weren't seeking him for reasons as high as they needed to be. Now, he had provided the day before a physical meal. And I don't doubt that because he miraculously multiplied those loaves and fishes, that it would have been delicious. And not anything wrong with them enjoying it. Not anything wrong with them being grateful for it. But if all they saw in Jesus was a man to provide a meal, a physical meal, then they weren't looking in Jesus for the highest things that they could be looking for. Jesus had much more important things to offer than the loaves and the fishes. And so he encouraged them to be more interested in higher things, to look at what it was they were aspiring to, elevate their aspiration, and to see that their reasons for coming to seek him weren't as high as they ought to be. Well, you and I don't come to Jesus for the loaves and the fishes. It's to be hoped that we would be looking for some higher things from the Lord than that. But what I want you to see is that even if we come looking for the relatively higher blessings, maybe even spiritual blessings, if it's still about us, then that's still not as high in terms of our motivation as we ought to be. If we're wanting those things and we're wanting them primarily for us, if we've turned this whole thing into a self-centered enterprise, then I think the Lord would say, you need to look at your motives. You need to look at what it is that you are seeking me for. Most of us listen to station WIFM. What's in it for me? Even when it comes to God, we're interested in, well, I'll just say it this way. We're more interested in God's blessings than we are in God Himself. We have a very utilitarian, pragmatic, practical approach to God. The word utilitarian has to do with utility, or what's useful, and what we want to know how useful God can be to us. We want to know what problems He can solve for us, and what pragmatic use we can make of God. And if God can't do things for us that we need to have done, then why have any dealings with God? We make it totally something that's about us. And I read a book several years ago by a lady who had, she'd been through some sufferings in her life, some ordeals, and so she'd written this book about her coping with those difficulties, and she was just very frankly angry with God. She said during all of her suffering, she'd prayed and prayed and prayed for God to make those problems go away, and she said God didn't make them go away, and she said, if God doesn't give us what we want, what good is God? Well, she's just saying in black and white what many people feel. Maybe they don't see that that's what they're thinking, but many people think, what possible reason could anybody have for dealing with God if there aren't things that He has that we want that He can give to us? And so we sometimes see God as a sort of a celestial Santa Claus who exists for the purpose of doing what we want. Several years ago, this ad came to me by email for what was called a voodoo machine. Well, don't you just get some wonderful things by email? Email is such an amazing thing. Experience feelings of inebriation, psychedelic visuals, extreme relaxation, floating sensations, intense endorphin releases. Well, I want some of those, don't you? That sounds pretty good. All culminating in a relaxed yet euphoric state. It's a completely electronic, drug-like experience, and it's entirely safe, legal, and beneficial in so many ways. Do you notice that word, beneficial? These are the benefits. Non-addictive narcotic substitute. You know, it's not a drug, but it's a narcotic-like thing. Relaxation, relief from stress, relieve depression and anxiety, fight insomnia. All for $19.95, I think it was. You just plug that voodoo machine in and suddenly you don't have insomnia, your depression, your anxiety goes away, you don't have stress, you're relaxed, you're just on a high all of the time. Well, you and I know no machine that you could buy for any amount of money would do all of that for you. But there are probably people who would send in $20 thinking, you know, if it's beneficial in all of these ways, if I can get these benefits, those are the benefits I want. Now, you'd think a voodoo machine like that is silly, but isn't that about what we want God to do for us when it all comes right down to it? We want Him to provide us some peace of mind so we can relax and won't be stressed out. We want God to relieve our depression and anxiety and help us to be able to go to sleep at night. If God doesn't do these things for us, some people would say, what good is God? That's why we deal with God, is to solve problems like this for us. And so we see God basically as a glorified voodoo machine. Or as a cow. Meister Eckhart centuries ago said, some people want to see God with their eyes as they see a cow, and to love Him as they love their cow, for the milk and cheese and profit that it brings to them. This is how it is, he said, with people who love God for the sake of outward wealth or inward comfort. We're several centuries past the agricultural age when Meister Eckhart wrote, and most people had milk cows. Now, we can get that stuff at HEB. We don't worry about that. But this inward comfort, that's what we want from God, isn't it? And we many times think that's why God exists. That's His main job description, is to help me have inward comfort. And if God doesn't do that, what good is God? What possible reason could anybody have for having anything to do with God if he doesn't provide benefits like that? Well, self-centered motives are just not strong enough to keep us going over the long haul. If all you can think of is, what can I get out of this? Then you need to look at your aspiration, your motives. If you're not strongly motivated to be seeking God, it may be because you're just dabbling around here in these very self-centered motives of seeing what kind of blessings that you can get out of God. Now, some self-centered motives are higher on the scale of nobility than others. Coming to God for spiritual blessings is relatively higher on the scale than coming to God for the loaves and the fishes. But even so, if you go all the way up to the highest scale in terms of what you want from God, even heaven itself, if that's primarily about you, then you're not going to be as strongly motivated as you would be if you sought God for higher reasons than anything that he can give to you for your benefit, as if this whole thing was about you. So what would be the right reason for seeking God? If you wanted to seek God for the highest motive and therefore be the most highly motivated to seek God, what would it be? Remember, we've said motive is the key to motivation. So we're wanting more motivation, but we don't want to just shovel more coal into the boiler. We don't want just more quantity of motivation. We want a higher quality of motivation. What would it be? Well, you know what it is. You've known it as long as I have. Love, pure love for God himself, for his sake, and not primarily for ours. Jesus was asked in Matthew 22, what was the most important commandment in the law? That's what he said. He quoted from Deuteronomy chapter 6, you shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, and all of your mind. Well, it's very easy to say that, very easy for preachers to preach sermons on loving the Lord with all of our hearts and our souls and our minds. But I'm going to tell you, it's very hard to do that and to love the Lord with a pure, unconditional, unselfish love. We sometimes don't do as well loving God with an unconditional love as we do loving even other people with an unconditional love. We understand, don't we, that in terms of human love, if the only reason you love somebody is for how useful they can be to you, for what benefit they can be to you, that's not a very high love, is it? Several years ago, I preached these lessons in a certain place where, at that time, I did these lessons in a different order. And so that particular week, I had already presented this lesson. And so then I was in somebody's home the next night for supper. And at the supper table, the husband in this family just attacked me at the table. I mean, not physically, but he lashed into me about this point. He said, Gary, that's just pure ridiculous. He said, the blessings that we can get from God, he says, that's what it's about. He said, God wouldn't be a good God if he didn't bless us. And so he just really vigorously opposed the idea of loving God unconditionally. And so I've always been known for my tact. And so I looked at his wife and I said, does he love you that way too? For how useful you can be to him? For what he can get out of you? If you were in a car accident and suddenly became a quadriplegic and he had to care for you the rest of his life and there was absolutely nothing else that you could do for him the rest of his life, would he leave you? And she lowered her eyes and looked down in a way that indicated to me that that probably is the way he loved her. He didn't know anything about any kind of love except for how useful people can be to you. And he thought about God that way. Well, you know, a fellow like that, a horsewhip would be too good for him. You know, if he just loved his wife because of how pragmatic she could be for certain services that she could render to him, That's a very low concept of love in human terms. But we will turn right around when it comes to God and not be able to even envision loving God except in terms of how useful he can be to us, what problems he can solve, benefits and blessings that he can provide for us Have you even tried to think about the concept of loving God unconditionally? Because He's God, because it's inherent in the creator-creature relationship that the creature loves its creator, and especially if it turns out that He is a good God, benevolently inclined toward His creatures, that we would desire to love Him for His sake, with all of our hearts and our souls and our minds. It's a hard concept for some people to understand who've never even tried to think in these terms, but religion is not about us. It's about God. We seek God. We are to seek Him, period. Blessings would be icing on the cake. Fringe benefits, extra blessings that just make it better. We seek God with or without the trimmings because He is God. We love Him unconditionally. What did you have in mind when you became a Christian? Did you have any kind of rough idea in your mind about how life was going to go as a Christian? What it was going to be like? Most people had some kind of vague scenario. They thought that was going to be better than the life they would have if they didn't become a Christian. So they signed on to become a Christian because, well, it looks like that path through life would be a little bit more pleasant than the path that I would be on otherwise. Well, regardless of how you thought it was going to go when you became a Christian, I would almost guarantee that it's gone differently than you thought it was going to go, haven't you? There have been some unexpected twists and turns in the path. Maybe in some ways it's been more pleasant than what you thought it was going to be. Other ways you might have found that it was more difficult than you thought. You may have found that there was some pain, maybe some persecution. I mean, not in this country, but certainly in other parts of the world, there might be persecution for being a Christian. I think Paul, if you read his life, would report that his life was much harder after he became a Christian than it was before. So what happens in the life of most people when, before they become a Christian, they anticipate, here's how it's going to go. Here's this pleasant path. This be a Christian, and here's this pleasant path through life that being a Christian will lead me. And then they find out that the truth is the path is very different than what they thought they had in mind. It ends up being much more difficult, maybe even more painful than what they thought. And what do many people do under those circumstances? They quit. Why? Because it wasn't God they were seeking, it was a particular path to God that attracted their interest. And if the path turned out to be not what they wanted, then they're out of there because it was the path, it was the scenario, it was the circumstances, the blessings that they wanted. And if those things weren't there, then, as that lady said, what good is God? That's the way most people think. We've been talking this weekend about seeking God. What I'm trying to say to you in this lesson is that must be unconditional. We seek Him, wanting to go toward Him where He is and see His face through whatever path takes us there. Whatever path He deems it wise to bring us home to Him, we would settle for that path, whatever it was, because it's not the path that we're seeking, it's Him. And we'd be willing to go toward Him through a difficult path as much as an easy one, a pretty one as well as an ugly one. Scenery-wise, I mean, it just doesn't matter to us what the circumstances are. We might have preferences about one set of circumstances or another. But with Paul, we'll say, I only want that Christ to be magnified in my body, whether by life or by death. I might prefer this scenario, but if the Lord has another scenario in mind, all I want is God, and I'm not concerned about the particulars. The question was asked by Satan in the book of Job, at the beginning of Job. Does Job serve the Lord for naught? Job had been well blessed as a faithful man of God. And Satan's implication was that Job would quit serving God if God took away the blessings. And what did the devil find out when he was allowed to make that test? That Job had an unconditional faith and love for God that stood strong even when it no longer paid him to be faithful. If a similar test were carried out in your life, how far would it go before you renounce the Lord? If the devil was given, were given permission to start withdrawing your blessings one by one, how many would have to be withdrawn before you quit serving the Lord? If you're like Job, you'd keep serving if it killed you. Because you're seeking God. For His sake, unconditionally. You love Him. I preached these lessons one time and a man, gospel preacher, came up to me afterward. He said, but Gary, you preach the lesson that God is a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him. I said, yeah, but read it again. God is a rewarder of those who seek Him. The minute our focus gets off of God, onto the question of whether we do or don't have any particular set of blessings that we think we desire, then we lose God, and we usually lose the enjoyment of the blessings themselves. That's the message of Ecclesiastes. That even in terms of the temporal blessings in this life, you get the most out of them by not paying any attention to them. Fear God and keep His commandments. That's the whole duty of man. And then you get God and the best that this world has to offer. But the minute you take your focus off of God and you start worrying about whether I've got the life I want, even thinking God can give it to me, then you lose God and you lose this too. So it's kind of like, it's serendipity. You know what serendipity is? It's when you find something unexpectedly that you weren't looking for. I found a DVD in the refrigerator not too long ago. I must have put it there, but I found it while I was looking for a Dr. Pepper, you know? And you will find immense blessings in the course of seeking God. In heaven, you may find some considerably good ones in the here and now. We've enjoyed some this weekend, haven't we? But with or without those blessings, God is still God. And our seeking of Him can't be contingent on whether the path is pleasant or not. One writer said, if there's some place you desperately need to get to, and somebody's told you the right road that you need to take to get there, you don't too much worry about whether the scenery is pretty or whether this is a pleasant road. All you're concerned about is this the right road that gets me where I need to go. And so, that's the way it is in our seeking of the Lord. We seek Him by any path, at any price, at any sacrifice, under any circumstances, unconditionally seeking God for His sake and not for ours. Matthew 6 and 33, Jesus, in teaching that we ought not to worry about the physical blessings of life, food and clothing and shelter, said, seek first the kingdom, that is the rule of God and His righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you. What are these things in that passage? Well, they are the physical blessings, food, clothing and shelter. But the principle applies even to spiritual blessings. When do you get the spiritual or the physical blessings? When you quit worrying about whether you're getting blessings or not and put your focus on God, seek first His rule and His righteousness, and then all of these things, spiritual and temporal, will be supplied to you according to the Lord's wisdom. You'll get everything else you need if you quit worrying about what you're getting and get your focus on something that's much more important than any of our blessings, and that is God Himself. Several times this weekend, I've recommended to you attitudes that I believe are attitudes we ought to have that I'm still working on. I'm a work in progress just like you are. And I'm struggling toward trying to think about these things as I should. One of the things I'm working on is that I hope before my life is over, if I could get to the point where I love God and seek only His glory enough. All I want is that He would be most greatly glorified, no matter what that means for me. That if I stood before the Lord in the judgment day, and He said to me, Gary, I would be more greatly glorified by the sentence of condemnation being passed upon you rather than that sentence being commuted. That I would bow my head reverently and say, Thy will be done.
I only want that you be most greatly glorified, whatever that means for me. Do you see how much different seeking God is from what most people have in mind when they talk about trying to get God to be what they want Him to be and trying to get Him to give them what they want in life and writing books that say if He doesn't do what we want, what good is God? We have become so obsessed in our society with ourselves that we have turned even religion into something that we think is about us. Several years ago, I was a young man. That would be several years ago, wouldn't it? I was involved in some rather intense controversy at that time on some religious topics, and there were some people who just didn't care for me at all because of some things that I had taught. And at that point in my life, I was worried about what they thought about me. And I was renting a room at that time with an elderly sister who really had a good influence on me during the months that I rented a room from her. One day she just sat me down. She could tell that I was concerned about this controversy and what people were saying and what people were thinking. And she said, "Gary," she said, "you'd worry a whole lot less about what people think about you if you realized how rarely they do." She had a point. We spend a lot of time worrying whether the universe is going to rightly orient itself to us, rarely stopping to think that the universe really doesn't take much thought for us most of the time. It's not about us. We are bit players in this drama. We are allowed to spend eternity in the presence of the King. We'll be in a place we don't deserve to be. It'll be pure grace. He could have been a good God and left us lost. Anything after our rebellion, anything we get from God is pure grace. We're grateful for it. We understand that God is whom this is about and not us. So learning a deeper desire for God Himself. God Himself is what this life is all about. The highest prayer we can pray is, "Lord, help us to rightly relate ourselves to Your glory." And then You just tell us what our assignment is, and we'll be glad to fulfill it. Quickly, what changes can we make as a result of these lessons this week? Number one, if this is about God, then we need to spend more time thinking about God. But spend that time thinking about Him and not what He can do for you that you want done. You may find it difficult if you're not in the habit of doing that to think for 5 seconds about God without letting some request or some demand come in there. But if you can only do it for 5 seconds, try doing it for 6 seconds tomorrow. Try to spend more time thinking about God, His worthy attributes, and to praise Him and to worship Him, to think about His character. We need to spend more time thinking about God. When it comes to prayer, we need to work on learning real prayer, learning to truly communicate with God. What's the longest that you've ever prayed at one time? I don't know what your answer would be to that, but I know most Americans never, ever pray long enough to get past the chit-chat with God, the small talk. You want an interesting experience? Go rent a hotel room or go to a state park or some isolated place. Take the day off. Commit yourself to praying for 12 hours to God. After the first few minutes, you will have exhausted the chit-chat that you normally engage in, that you call prayer. And there might be some hours of awkward silence before that 12-hour period is over. But before that's over, you probably will have really started communicating with God. Honestly communicating with Him. Talking with Him about what's really on your heart. And not striking a pose that you think would be pretty in God's sight. If you don't like God, honest prayer would be to admit to Him that you don't like Him. And to ask for help in overcoming that attitude. If you don't seek Him as diligently as you ought to, honest prayer would be to admit that. He knows it already. He wants you to admit it. To communicate with God honestly from the heart for a long enough period of time that it becomes real to us. We need to work on that. The other side of prayer, of course, is Bible study. And we could elevate the reasons why we study our Bible by starting to study the Scriptures for the primary purpose of purifying our concepts of God Himself. Studying the Bible to learn more truth about God. All of us have some wrong ideas in our minds about God. We study the Bible primarily to get rid of those erroneous concepts and have them replaced by true concepts of God as He really is. So we can learn to study the Bible for higher reasons. And fourth, we can set some goals. Specific goals for growth in our obedience. None of us are where we need to be with respect to our obedience. But we doom ourselves so many times by never doing anything more than saying, well, you know, I need to do better in certain areas. Well, we need to be specific about the areas we need to do better in and specific about how we intend, with the Lord's help, to do better. Set some specific goals. So that this time next week or next month or next year, here is specifically what I want to be doing better in with regard to God. We tend to get in ruts, don't we, and get in a plateau where we maybe grew for a while after we obeyed the gospel, but then we quit growing. The reason is we don't set any specific things that we want to do better. So we need to work on our obedience. But finally, the most important thing I can recommend to you is that we need to learn to practice the principle of sacrifice. Quit giving the Lord that which costs us nothing. Very few people ever give the Lord anything that costs them very much. We tend to give only that which we think we can afford to give. And I'm not here just talking about the collection plate. I'm talking about our time, our love, our energy. All of that, we tend to only give that which is relatively easy to give. And beyond that, we say, well, I can't afford that. When was the last time you gave a gift to the Lord that you couldn't afford to give? I mean a gift that truly hurt. You couldn't see how you could survive without that. But you gave it not. We're not talking here about works righteousness. We're not talking about earning your way into heaven. We're talking about love. Love gives extravagantly. Love doesn't count the cost. Love will give sacrificially. So your love for the Lord, when has it prompted you to give something truly costly to Him? I mentioned Grant in one of these other lessons and his love for golf. I'll share a little story with him about sacrificial giving. After we moved to Indiana, he was a sophomore in high school this particular year on the golf team, but as a sophomore, he was the low man on the totem pole. And he came down to the end of the season lacking playing in one varsity event to get his golf letter. In the last tournament of the season, the coach called up the night before and said, Grant, one of the other guys is sick. If you can play tomorrow, I can use you and you'll get your letter. Well, Grant reported the next afternoon for the tournament. It was a Wednesday afternoon. And as the last man to tee off, he could look at his watch and tell that if he played that round of golf, he would miss Wednesday night Bible study. I didn't know about this until afterward. This wasn't my decision. He turned to his coach and said, Coach, I can't play this afternoon. Coach said, what? You can't play. He said, I can't play and get to Bible study tonight. Coach exploded. So is there something special going on at Bible study tonight? No, just Wednesday night Bible study. But that's more important to me than golf. That kid gave up his golf letter that year to be at Wednesday night Bible study. And you'd have to know how much Grant loves golf to understand what a sacrifice that was. You ever given anything like that up for the Lord? You sacrifice for those whom you love, but it works the other way too. You'll love people a whole lot more for whom you sacrifice. You'll love the Lord a whole lot more if you learn to give costly gifts to Him because you love Him. What's the costliest gift you've ever given? I know what it is in my life. Before I left San Antonio, after Linda had left our family years before, and I had scripturally put her away. I believe if anybody had a scriptural cause to remarry, I would have. But after she'd been gone for quite a while, I decided for 5 or 6 very practical reasons, not because I thought scripturally I couldn't remarry, but just for several very practical reasons, that it'd be better if I not remarry, just devote the rest of my life to the Lord's work and to my kids. And I knew myself well enough to know if I didn't bind that with a pretty strong commitment, I wouldn't hold to that. And so I took a vow before the Lord to remain celibate the rest of my life. And I was told by some of my dear brethren at West Avenue at the time that that was crazy. One individual said in particular, Gary, he said, the time's going to come when you're going to want to remarry. And you're going to be awfully sorry you took that vow. And I said to him at the time, I said, so what are you saying? You're saying the only time we should give anything to the Lord is when we're absolutely sure that we won't ever have any use for that ourselves. Fact was, I knew how costly that gift would be even when I gave the gift. But I had no idea how costly it would be. It has ended up being much more costly than I ever thought. But I love the Lord at a deeper level than I could have ever learned to love Him any other way. There are days when I'm not sure that I can survive one more day without a mate. But when that pain assails me, as it frequently does, I remind myself of the one for whom I gave that up. And I recognize that the advantages that I sought by giving that gift to the Lord are still in place. Those advantages are still advantages. And I must seek to use those in the Lord's work. But that was a costly gift. And I think I learned for the first time in my life, what it means to give something that you don't see how you can live without it. And you've got to trust the Lord's going to keep you going. So I recommend that to you. Because it's about God. It's not about us. Gratitude for grace is the thing that makes us diligent in our seeking of God. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 15 verses 9 and 10, he wasn't worthy to be an apostle. He said, because I persecuted the church, I'm not worthy to be called an apostle. But by the grace of God, I am what I am, and His grace toward me was not in vain, but I labored more abundantly than they all. If you just grant for the sake of argument that Paul was the hardest working apostle, why was he the hardest working apostle? Because he was under the deepest debt of gratitude for the Lord's grace, after given what he had done before he obeyed the gospel. Paul saw himself as being less worthy to be an apostle than the rest of the guys, and so he spent the rest of his life saying thank you. Remember the story in Luke chapter 7 when Jesus was in the home of Simon the Pharisee and the immoral woman of that city came in and was washing the Lord's feet with her tears? Simon was indignant. She's an immoral woman. How can you let her touch you, Jesus? And Jesus said, Simon, you didn't wash my feet when I came in, but she's washed my feet with her tears. She has loved much. So she was doing everything she could to show her appreciation for grace. What was the difference between her and Simon? She had big sins, he had little ones? No. The difference was she saw the magnitude of her sins and he didn't see the magnitude of his. And so she loved the Lord more. She would seek the Lord more diligently because she was in touch with how unworthy she was to even approach the Lord. And you'll start seeking the Lord diligently when you realize how gracious He's been to even let you seek Him after what you've done. None of us deserves to even be anywhere close to God. And when we can begin to understand the magnitude of the grace that He had to show to let us, let me approach Him. And nobody's going to have to talk us into being at Wednesday night Bible study or to say, you need to do this. We want to do those things out of love for God Himself. That'll move us in His direction. The Bible is a love story. If our lives are not being moved by love for God, then we've not really read the Bible. So that's what it's about. So my prayer for you as we come to the end of this is twofold. Number one, that you'll start taking God more seriously. Quit playing games and start seeking God more diligently. And specifically, that whatever for you is the next step that you need to take, that you'll take it. I don't know what that is for you, because I don't know where you are in relationship to God right now. But all of us have some next step that's waiting for us to take. And whatever that is for you, I'm going to challenge you to take it. It may not be anything I need to know about or anybody else in this room needs to know about. But if you know and God knows the next thing that you need to take care of in your relationship with Him, I'm challenging you, take that step. And if only one of you would do that, that'd make this whole weekend worthwhile. I preached these lessons in Kingsport, Tennessee about a year ago. And after the last lesson, everybody else had almost left the building. Young man, he looked to be maybe 10 or 11 years old, came up to me. He was dressed. He had a blue blazer on, I think, and khaki pants and a tie. And he came up and stuck his hand out and said, "Brother Henry, I just want to tell you." He said, "Whether anybody else in this congregation does anything about these lessons," he says, "I'm going to take the next step." I said, "Yes, it was worth it to be there." So who's going to take some step in this congregation? I don't ever need to know about it. Unless somebody does something specifically different, then we will have wasted our time. So you spend some time with the Lord before you go to bed tonight, and you identify what it is that you need to be doing, step you need to take. Even if it's a small one, He'll affirm that step and help you to take the next one. But do something differently. Well, I've spoken way over time tonight. This is my last chance to go over time. So I took it. Well, I've come to love you so much in a big hurry. You just are an exceptional bunch of people. You really are. And you've encouraged me not to give up, but to keep going. In fact, the devil better get out of my way for the next day or two. I'm going to kick him in the backside. I'm ready to get back to work. So thank you for being who you are, for us being together this week, and for the way that you've engaged in these studies. Let's all keep on keeping on. We're working in different parts of the vineyard, different places in the country, but we're still serving the same Lord and still doing His work. So let's keep doing that until He comes. And it is going to be worth it one of these days. If we can assist you either in obeying the gospel, if you've never confessed your faith and repented of your sins and been baptized into Christ, then that's the step you need to take. You can't really get started taking the other steps until you are in Christ. And obeying the gospel will put you in Christ, forgive you of your sins, and give you the hope of heaven that we've been talking about this weekend. If you are a Christian, but there's some public step you need to take that this church needs to know about, then we'd be delighted to hear what you have to say about that and encourage you and pray with you and help you in every way we can. Won't you come while we stand and sing the song?